Today on Against the Grain, few thinkers have shaped the world as much as Karl Marx, although the ways that he changed it may not have been to his liking, as my guest today argues. I'm Sasha Lilly. David McNally will join me to talk about the ideas and legacy of Karl Marx to mark the bicentennial of his birth. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Karl Marx was born in Prussia 200 years ago on May 5, 1818. Yet arguably, the dynamically destructive capitalism he analyzed in works such as Capital describes our world even more acutely than the 19th century one that he inhabited. A thinker of tremendous brilliance, Marx's legacy is a complicated one, owing to the 20th century societies established in his name. To talk about some of Marx's central ideas and sort out Marx's vision from those of his successors, I'm joined by David McNally. He's professor of political science at York University in Toronto, a longtime activist, and the author of many books, including Monsters of the Market and Global Slump, which in the interest of full disclosure, I should say I edited and is published by PM Press, which I'm connected to. David, why should we care about Marx? He died 135 years ago, and on the right and in the center, he's seen as a failed prophet of a disastrous social system, as witnessed by the Soviet Union. On parts of the left, he's seen as irrelevant in times where struggles over race and gender may seem more important than struggles over class. So why should we still return to the ideas of Marx?
I would start by saying that the world we live in today more resembles the world that Marx saw coming into being when he was writing his great texts in political economy than at any other time in history. And so really, the first question with respect to Marx's relevance is, do we live in a global capitalism? And if the answer to that is yes, then the next question becomes, does that global capitalism display some of the key characteristics that Marx said were intrinsic to the system? And by that, I mean increased and heightened forms of exploitation of labor, including casualization, precarious work, growing insecurity for huge numbers of people, intense social inequality, which becomes more exaggerated, particularly in our so-called neoliberal age? And is the system, as Marx suggested, globalizing? After all, in Marx's day, capitalism was essentially in one corner of the European continent. And yet I think most commentators would agree that today it is a genuinely world or global system. And so the first part of the question of Marx's relevance is really, does our world today consist of a capitalist society with the dynamics and the tensions that he described? And my submission would be that, in fact, it does so more than ever before, and this gives Marx's work an immense social and historical explanatory power and social and political relevance. Now, the other side of the question that you raised is really about whether Marx's concerns with class have been historically transcended by new identities and new movements with respect to gender or race, sexuality, ability, and so on. And I would come at that in two ways. The first would be to say that there is no doubt that Marx did not attend to many of these phenomena to the degree to which many current social critics and social justice activists would like to do. In other words, that if Marx remains relevant, it also is the case that there's a lot of work to do to renovate and update his analyses in ways that speak to a whole range of concerns around identity and oppression that he either didn't discuss or in some cases discussed in a way that we would find too cursory, too superficial. And so that's the first aspect that I think is important here. But the other side of this question with respect to class and identity and so on is really to ask, even if these social oppressions around gender, sexuality, race, and ability, for instance, are of more pressing concern to many of us than they were in Marx's day, can we adequately understand them and can we adequately address them without an analysis of capitalist class relations, the social inequalities that they produce, and so on? And again, I think one of the really interesting things about so many developments in these areas in recent years, particularly, I would say, since the global financial crisis of 2009 and the rise of movements like Occupy, all of the movements that have been highlighting social inequality, is that growing numbers of anti-racists, feminists, queer activists, environmental activists, and the like have actually been trying to turn to Marx to integrate a much richer anti-capitalism into their understanding of the world. And so it seems to me that Marx remains highly relevant to people who in the first instance enter political criticism and action around more identity-based oppressions than, say, typical or traditional working class politics. And I would add as a sort of final note to that, one of the things, of course, we're seeing increasingly as well today is that it is very often the gendered and racialized sections of the working class who are most significantly moving into social protest and social opposition, whether we're talking about the wave of teacher strikes that we've seen in parts of the US or fast food worker organizing across North America and so on. So to say that Marx has a continued relevance is not to say he has all the answers for every question we might ask 135 years later. It is more to say he is indispensable still to understanding how we go about addressing those issues.
What was Marx's background and his political evolution?
Marx's background is quite interesting, and I'll start here with an insight from the late Hal Draper, who wrote a very extensive four-volume work on the development of Marx's political thinking and practice. And he makes the comment in one of his volumes that Marx was the first socialist who came to socialism through the struggle for democracy. And I highlight that quote by Hal Draper because what he was trying to emphasize is that Marx was not the first socialist. The combination of all of the social transformations in Europe that we associate with the rise of capitalism, the agrarian and industrial revolutions, the French revolutions and the struggles for liberal democracy, and so on, that many earlier thinkers had started to move through those social transformations towards the idea of a new kind of social order, which they sometimes called socialism. And socialism usually for them meant that a system that addressed and tried to resolve the social problem, and the social problem was poverty. Now, interestingly, as Draper points out, because Marx came to this through the struggle for democracy, he began as a radical democrat, as a young journalist in the early 1840s in Germany. He was the editor of the most radical democratic newspaper of the era in 1842 and 1843. And it was because he came to the realization that the existing structure of social and property relations was a block on democracy that he then moved into the camp of socialism. And that's highly significant because what it means is that from the start, Marx's thinking about socialism is pitched in terms of radical democracy. And radical democracy beginning, of course, for the young Marx with the overcoming of alienated labor in the workplace, becomes really the index, the measure of any kind of socialist progress. So I think that's hugely important. In addition, Marx came out of a secularized Enlightenment Jewish household. In other words, although some of his grandfathers, excuse me, both of his grandfathers had been rabbis, his own father was highly secular. He had been deeply influenced by Enlightenment ideas about rationality and social progress. He had moved outside of really religious reference points. And so what Marx inherits there is a radical tradition inflected by what we sometimes call the radical Enlightenment, not its more liberal versions, but those elements of the Enlightenment which really believed that we had entered the age of popular sovereignty, of control of society by the people capable of reasoning about their own affairs. And so that also inflects and informs the ways in which Marx thinks about the struggle for socialism, and in particular, to what we've come to describe as the principle of self-emancipation. Consistent with that democratic principle that I was describing, Marx consistently, from 1843 until the end of his life in 1885, Marx consistently argued that socialism can only be brought about by the self-emancipation of the working class, or as he put it literally, only the working class can emancipate itself. And that, it seems to me, is a crucial part of the Marxian inheritance today. And interestingly, going back to the point about Marx's relevance, speaks, I think, very powerfully to contemporary concerns about creating more radical forms of social organization. And here I'm thinking of the assembly style decision making that the Occupy movement tried to develop. The same thing was happening, of course, in the 2011 revolution in Egypt, where hundreds of thousands of people seized Tahrir Square in Cairo and created new assembly-style structures of mass decision-making, or the movement of the squares roughly the same time in parts of Europe, particularly in Spain. In all of these social movements, and I would say, by the way, also in some of the recent teacher rebellions, where teachers have been calling mass assemblies to make decisions, we see this push towards a new kind of radical democracy from below that was really in keeping with Marx's commitments. The final element that I would add, and it's an often misunderstood one, is that Marx was deeply influenced by the philosophy of Hegel, George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, the philosophy which had dominated and then been marginalized, the German situation in the academy during his lifetime, Marx's lifetime as a student. And fundamentally what he got from that was the idea that we need to understand the world dynamically. Social reality is a process, not a thing. And as a result, if capitalism today does not look identical to the Victorian capitalism of 1860 that Marx saw in front of him when he was writing his great work, Capital, in London, that shouldn't surprise us, because Marx has tried to get us to see the system as one that's constantly transforming itself around the same basic social logic, the same structural principles. Similarly, he insisted that we try to see all social situations as relational, as involving relations between social groups, and not to imagine, as he put it, that capital is a thing. Capital is a social relationship. And so we're not just struggling against a power external to ourselves, we are struggling to change the social relationships in which we find ourselves. And that notion of transforming social relationships becomes, I think, crucial to his thinking. So those are the elements that I would really highlight: the democratic inheritance, the principle of self-emancipation and the way that comes out of a certain radical enlightenment tradition, and this insistence on understanding reality historically and dynamically and in terms of the social relations among people.
I'm speaking with activist and professor of political science at York University in Toronto, David McNally, about the legacy of Karl Marx. My name is Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. David, what was the interplay between the development of Marx's ideas over the course of his life and the social struggles that he saw around him and that he was engaged with? The most momentous earlier on in his life being the revolutions of 1848.
Yes, and picking up from one of our earlier points here, Sasha, it's really significant to highlight that as soon as Marx decided that he was in fact a person on the socialist left, he sought out working class clubs, working men's organizations. He was forced into exile, and so while he had some contact in Germany before he left, it was really in Paris in 1844 that he began to interact on a regular basis with left-wing working-class organizations of French workers and of German émigrés. And he always spoke throughout the rest of his life extremely reflectively and powerfully about the impact that those meetings, those discussions had on him. And he saw himself as being educated by workers in struggle. And that, of course, goes back both to the commitment to self-emancipation, as Marx really would say, one of the lines, of course, we have from the working class ballad, The Internationale, "We want no condescending saviors." Marx was very committed to that idea. He was no savior. He did not condescend to the working class. He sought to work alongside and within its movements. And that, of course, meant that when revolutions did break out, as you say, in 1848 in both France and Germany, that immediately he and his co-thinkers, they had been organized in two different groups, one called the League of the Just and the other called the Communist League, these two organizations. Then Marx worked with them as best he could to be part of those revolutions, to contribute particularly by writing pamphlets and documents that could be of service in those struggles. And for Marx, the class struggles of workers around him were the real laboratory of social revolution. And his job was not to prescribe, to dictate, or to legislate, but in fact to illuminate, to, as he puts it at one point, to clarify the struggles of the age. And that's what he sought to do with his involvement here. And that's why we also need to be careful sometimes taking a single text by Marx and ascribing to it a timeless status. Marx's texts are contextual. And as the world changed, as the working class struggle changed, so did his own thinking. And so let me offer you a few examples of how he learned from actual struggles in ways that changed his own thinking. First, there is the question of the state itself. In the Communist Manifesto in 1848, he and his lifelong friend Engels, Frederick Engels, had written that the working class needs to conquer the state. Then when the workers of Paris in 1871 rose up and established the Commune of Paris, the Paris Commune, Marx recognized that they weren't conquering the state, they were displacing it. They were substituting for the old state a new commune structure with direct delegates, grassroots organization, democracy in the communities and the workplace. And Marx and Engels, immediately after that event, wrote a new preface to the Communist Manifesto where they said, when we first wrote this, we said that the workers need to conquer the state. The workers of Paris have corrected us. They have shown that what workers need to do is to smash or dismantle the existing state and replace it with a commune. And so there's a beautiful example of not trying to prescribe the direction of history, but of learning from the struggles of workers. I'll offer one or two other examples. Marx spent a lot of time, of course, in Britain. And in the 1840s, when he arrived there, the key working class movement was called the Chartists, and it had that name due to its 10-point charter, which was a charter of working class rights, which included the right to vote. But in key leadership positions in the Chartist movement, the most important working class movement of the era in Britain, were Irish immigrants. And Marx was drawn to the radicalism of these Irish working class activists in England. And in particular, so was one of his daughters, Jenny, who became incredibly active in building solidarity with Irish struggles, and then as did his younger daughter, Eleanor. And in all kinds of conversations, Marx got won over in discussions with Chartists and with his own daughters to the idea that rather than having the view that the solution to the colonial oppression of Ireland was for the English workers to overthrow capitalism and essentially free the Irish, Marx was persuaded that no, the Irish struggle on its own can be a great lever of social upheaval throughout Great Britain. And so he moved to a position in the 1860s of advocating Irish independence, of supporting the anti-colonial struggle as itself of enormous merit in the social struggles of the day. And then the third example I'll give actually comes from America, where Marx was, as a growing number of analysts are recognizing today, hugely interested in the issue of slavery in the U.S. South, which, by the way, he considered a form of capitalist slavery. Contrary to some later so-called Marxists, Marx said, absolutely, this is a form of capitalist slavery. It is unlike any of the slavery we have seen before. And he was hugely interested in the movements of abolitionists in the U.S. He followed the uprising at Harper's Ferry led by John Brown, for instance. He talked about it as having world historic significance. And he said the same thing during the U.S. Civil War. Marx was among the first who was essentially calling for an Emancipation Proclamation from the beginning and for arming slaves who would cross over to Union lines. And during this period, you see slavery and the question of anti-black racism in the United States entering into Marx's theoretical reflections in ways that really have not been fully appreciated. And I think finally today, there are some scholars, I would mention Kevin Anderson and his book Marx at the Margins, who have started to draw attention to some of the significance of this line of thinking for Marx. But it was social struggles in the United States. It was his friends in the First International in the United States, particularly emigrant German socialist radicals in the US, who were drawing Marx into these conversations and changing his thinking. And so I highlight those because they are examples of not trying to prescribe in advance the course of history, but recognizing that Marx's commitment was, as I said, to clarifying the struggles of the age, and that requires learning.
Marx was incredibly prolific, but his masterwork is The Incompleted Capital. Why is it such an important and enduring work in your estimation? Volume 1 was published in 1867.
Yes, that's right. And you're absolutely right that if Marx's intellectual legacy rests on one work, it is Capital Volume 1. It's the only work of his great critique of political economy. It's the only volume that he saw to completion during his lifetime. And he simply left manuscripts afterwards. But Volume 1, it seems to me, is an unsurpassed account of how capitalism works. And it is that because Marx allows us to understand the truly mysterious nature of capitalism. It's incredible to sit and read that text today and to realize that in the 1860s, Marx was saying to us, do you realize that a world in which, in order to feed yourself, you must first go into some market institution like a store and hand over something called money in order to subsist and to feed yourself and the members of your household? Do you realize how odd it is that in order to house yourself, you need a contract and payments that go through a housing and rental market? Do you understand that for most of human life, most of human social existence, this is not how people stayed alive? And this is mysterious. There is something to be explained here. It is not natural. This is not how it has been across all the eons of human existence. And so we need to understand, as he says, the riddle of the commodity. How is it that the overwhelming bulk of the things that we need for social existence, food, shelter, clothing, recreational activities, books, music, computers, and so on, all of those are commodities that must be purchased through markets? And in setting out that way, Marx posed a problem that no one in the history of political economy up until that time, and no one in mainstream economic thinking ever has, which is to say, capitalism is a social and historical problem that must be explained. And the great brilliance of the work is then to say, ironically, capitalism claims to be a society about property rights. This is the one great claim to fame it makes everywhere, that people get property rights in our capitalist society. And yet, says Marx, the condition for capitalism coming into our world was that millions of people had to be deprived of their property. Millions of people had to be separated from their land, had to be removed from it, had to be denied access to it. And that is the story in the first instance of the great enclosure movements in Great Britain, by which peasants were driven off the land, land was enclosed and privatized. And I would argue it is the story of the great racial enclosure movement that happens with Atlantic slavery and the dispossession of 12 million Africans from their land and their being transmitted to markets in the New World as commodities. So that process of dispossession, of being separated from property, maybe the property was communally owned, not personally owned, but it was nonetheless property in the sense in which it was means of life to which people had guaranteed access. And so the brilliance of Marx's story is to say, this society is odd and irregular. It is not transhistorical. It has not been around forever. And contrary to its own claims, it rests upon dispossessing millions of property. And in telling that story of dispossession, which is known today as either the story of primitive accumulation, an awkward translation from Marx's German, or sometimes, as David Harvey has put it, of accumulation by dispossession. Capital accumulates wealth by dispossessing those who labor and giving them no other means of survival except to enter into the market and to sell their wage labor. Now, there's much more to Marx's Capital, but I would argue that what I've covered there in terms of the mystery of commodities and the historic truth of dispossession makes Marx's work more profound in terms of understanding capitalism than anything else we have been gifted with.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm joined by David McNally. He's the author of many books, including Monsters of the Market and Another World is Possible. And we're talking about the ideas of Karl Marx on the bicentennial of his birthday. I'm Sasha Lilly. David, we were talking about the ideas in Capital, and a decade earlier, before Volume 1 of Capital was published, Marx made extensive notes in a series of notebooks called the Grundrisse, or that's how we refer to it, which was not published until 1939. And the Grundrisse has evoked a lot of interest. To what degree do the ideas in the Grundrisse differ from those of Capital, and are the two works complementary, if we can talk about some large volume of writing about wide-ranging topics?
Yes, I do see the works as continuous or compatible, which is not to say, of course, that there aren't real differences. The Grundrisse is really a set of notebooks full of Marx's assessments of other thinkers. He often moves down different tangents as he's trying to clarify his own thinking about, say, money and its different historical forms and that sort of thing. It is has much more the character of personal notebooks than the very polished literary text that Capital Volume 1 is. But I think people have been drawn repeatedly back to the Grundrisse because it shows Marx's thought process, and it shows a whole series of commitments that I would argue ought to be clear from Capital Volume 1, but for many readers, for all kinds of historical reasons, were not clear. And in particular, and the thing which grabbed so many readers of the Grundrisse in the 1950s and 60s, is the continuous recurrence of Marx's discussion of alienation and alienated labor. That had been a primary category in Marx's early economic and philosophical manuscripts from 1844. And some commentators had argued, well, those youthful enthusiasms about disalienating labor and developing forms of worker self-management, of disalienated labor, that all of this Marx later gave up as silly and youthful, and really he had become some kind of state socialist. And of course, you can see those whose loyalties were to the Soviet Union and so on often gravitated towards that sort of analysis. Therefore, they argued that Marx had abandoned these concerns with alienation. Well, all of a sudden, here was evidence repeatedly across the text that Marx was using the concept of alienation, and he was talking about the overcoming of alienated labor as, if you will, the fundamental task of socialist transformation of society. So I think that was hugely important to a lot of people. Now, I would argue, if you read Capital carefully, you can see all of those concerns there, particularly in the famous Section 4 of Chapter 1 on the fetishism of commodities. I think all of those concerns with alienation are clearly evident there. Also, something I was referring to earlier gets highlighted in these Grundrisse notebooks, and that's Marx's grasp of the technological dynamism of capitalism. You see him really developing an understanding that the competition among different capitalists and different sectors of capital forces a continuous process of innovation by which one capitalist develops new labor-saving technologies that will allow them to get a competitive edge, to produce the same commodity more quickly and therefore more cheaply with less labor time and less labor costs. And of course, what that does, and it gives it a huge contemporary relevance, is that raises the specter of ongoing automation within capitalism. And again, while I would say that's there in Capital, Marx spends a lot more time, because he's clarifying his own thinking He spends a lot more time, therefore, emphasizing this technological dynamism, the continual replacement of workers by new forms of machinery and of older forms of machinery by new technologies. And so we get an image of capitalism which is very contemporary and very relevant to our current moment. It's fascinating to see a great social theorist at work in his own intellectual laboratory, and that's what we get there. So I don't think that there is anything in that text which is hugely inconsistent with Capital, but I think we get to see him working through problems. The other point I would make about it is it really reminds us of the open-endedness of Marx's thinking, the ways in which he saw every analysis as provisional and unfinished. Of course, we need to be able to understand the world in which we live to the greatest degree possible, with the fullest of our capacities. But we also need always to recognize the unfinishedness, the incomplete character of all analysis. And that's why, going back to a point we touched on earlier, those Marxist feminists who come along today and want to extend and develop Marx on gender and the family, those anti-racist Marxists who pick up some of Marx's scattered reflections on slavery and racism and develop them way more robustly than Marx ever did, I think are really in the spirit of Marx's commitment to ongoing experimentation and development of a living body of work, not a static set of principles and propositions sort of somehow meant for all time.
Let me ask you about Marx and a vision of life after capitalism. Marx cautioned about writing recipes for the cookbooks of the future. And yet his writings do indicate in different ways some key aspects of how he imagined people to be and the centrality of their liberation in a post-capitalist world. Yet it's very hard to read Marx and to think about Marx and life after capitalism without being pulled down by the baggage of history, because so much of the generalizations that are made about Marx and Marx thinking about life after capitalism are shaped by the disaster of the Soviet experience and so on. But reading Marx himself, what can we pick up on in thinking about life beyond capitalism?
That truly is a great question. And you're right that Marx's allergy to recipes for the future really came from that principle that the workers must discover for themselves the new social forms, the institutions that will be necessary to creating a free post-capitalist society. And therefore, it would be elitist arrogance for him to prescribe in advance what a future society ought to look like. But nevertheless, I think you're right that we can still draw a whole series of principles that are, if you will, give us the spirit, the ethos of what his thinking, based on the working class struggles of his age that he was participating in, the principles that would logically follow from those. And so we've touched on one of those, which is disalienating labor. The idea that workers need to be subjected to authoritarian managerial control rather than being democratically self-organized and self-managing in places of work, I think that runs through Marx repeatedly and clearly is a, if you will, a guiding principle, even if there's no cookbook there. It is a guiding principle that informs his work. I would say the same thing about all of the references to social cooperation within Marx. Marx is in that great socialist tradition of cooperativism. He imagines that human cooperation can be foundational to a social order. that a society does not need to be organized along principles and lines of market competition. And he talks repeatedly about this. While he didn't believe that it would be possible to incrementally transform capitalism by creating workers' cooperatives here and there, he thought there was no way that you could break the rule of capital by creating a cooperative bike shop or a cooperative bookshop or what have you. He did nevertheless always say these are very instructive examples. They show us the capacities of workers to self-manage. And so cooperation and worker self-management, it seems to me, are absolutely central there. Similarly, Marx is very insistent on the idea that our social labor time ought to be radically reduced. He calls this the expansion of free time, the time, as he puts it, for free human self-development. Of course, every society is going to require that healthy, able-bodied people be contributors to meeting social needs, whether they're doing elder care, whether they are helping to construct housing, whether they're caring for children, whether they are helping with food servicing and food production. We're going to need people's labor. But, said Marx, we are going to try to use cooperative organization and the highest technologies available to us to radically reduce the time we spend engaged in social labor so that more and more of life becomes developmental and recreational, where we pursue our personal needs and interests unencumbered by the requirements of showing up to work 40 hours or more a week, 5 days a week for 40 some odd years of our lives. And then I would add finally that there is, to Marx, a great anti-colonial, anti-imperialist internationalism. That is why from the beginning he says things like, the workers have no country, the workers have no fatherland. Marx's vision is that capitalism is becoming a global system, and the workers need to be even more globalist, even more internationalist in their outlooks. And therefore, this means overcoming all of the inequalities between nations as we move towards a true world community of people that doesn't lock any of us into national identities and national borders, but at the same time is respectful of cultural differences, which can be part of the great mosaic of a truly global society. So I think all of those values, or that ethos, as I said earlier, is there in Marx, and we need to insist upon it in the aftermath of the experiences of Stalinism historically. The development of the bureaucratic police state with one party in Russia did an immense historical disservice to socialism and to the whole of the socialist mission. And I think we can use Marx effectively to show that there is an entirely different socialist tradition that need not be complicit with that and need not be compromised by that Soviet experience.
I want to end by asking you, David, about the durability of capitalism since Marx's time. Marx certainly wrote about the dynamism of capitalism, but do you think that he underestimated its dynamism, that, you know, we still have capitalism 135 years after his death, after a time which seemed like an age of revolution that seems to have then ebbed?
I think that what Marx underestimated was the effects that capitalism's technological dynamism could have when exploited by dominant classes on the working class as a whole. Marx was fundamentally optimistic about the capacities of the working class to understand the world in order to change it. And I don't think that he was fundamentally wrong in that regard, but I think he simplified what has turned out to be a much more complex task. And you can see why in his own lifetime. In his own lifetime, he sees the working class socialist left go from mere circles to eventually building cross-border organizations with international aspirations. He sees mass movements. He sees the Paris Commune, and workers actually seize power for over 70 days in Paris, and so on. And so I think he saw a developmental trajectory of the working class growing ever more conscious of its situation and ever more organized in response to it. And I think what he didn't see, and it's difficult to blame him for this, but it's something that we need to see, is that capital can actually use moments of great social unrest and social instability to enormously restructure industry and capitalist production, and to massively restructure the state and social life. And so obviously, for us, the most pressing example of that is the way in which capitalism was able to restructure itself coming out of the social and political crises of the 1960s, associated with the civil rights movement, black power, women's liberation, gay liberation in the United States, for instance, the massive general strike of 1968 in France, the hot autumn of factory occupations in 1969 in Italy, and then rolling into the 1970s with mass anti-war struggles and the great wave of wildcat strikes even inside the United States, for instance. And capitalism used an immense process of restructuring, which literally destroyed working class communities. The coal mining communities of Britain are basically gone. Many of the historic working class communities of the industrial Midwest in the United States are gone. The Bolivian tin miners' communities are overwhelmingly gone. And the disappearance of workplaces, of industries, is also the destruction of infrastructures of dissent, of those practices and institutional spaces where working class cultures were nourished and reproduced historically, where everybody knew of the great strikes that had been waged and traditions were passed on. And those processes of capitalist restructuring disorient the working class, and to use a category that some Italian Marxists have used, they decompose the working class. And so we get these cycles of decomposition, and then we try to enter into cycles of recomposition. And in those cycles of recomposition, the working class doesn't look the same as it once did. The kinds of workplaces it works in are different. The kinds of industries and technologies with which it operates are different. The social media, the technologies of everyday life, the practices of everyday life, the way working class communities are organized, all of this changes, and working class organization needs to change with it. And so I think Marx didn't foresee how restructuring could produce these cycles of decomposition. But I think at the same time, his immense confidence in the ability of working people to learn, to reorganize themselves, to get up from every nasty and brutal period and reorganize and resist and fight back. And I would again cite the teacher strikes that we've been seeing in the United States recently as a beautiful example of that. That confidence is something we need to hold on to. Yes, I think Marx simplified a much more complex social process, but that confidence is important because it allows us to hold to the idea that one of our tasks is to still contribute to clarifying the struggles of the age in ways that assist the self-organization of working class people today. And so even if we see Marx as having not attended to some of those complexities, I think we can see him as adhering to a fundamental confidence which represents a solidarity, a commitment to self-emancipation, that even if he died in 1883, remains a legacy which we can hold on to today, and which I think is important when we enter into a period of recomposition of working class struggles, which I think it is arguable we may have entered in recent years.
David McNally, thank you so much for your time today.
It's my pleasure, Sasha, as always.
I've been speaking with activist and professor of political science at York University, David McNally. He's the author of many books, including Against the Market. And in the interest of full disclosure, I should say that I've edited a book of David's, Global Slump, published by PM Press, which I'm connected with. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.